Hello, and welcome to Clinical Attrition Notes, a podcast where we speak with guest experts and opinion leaders about the art and science of clinical nutrition, brought to you by Nestle Health Science Canada. This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals for education purposes. I'm your host, Bethany Hopkins, Medical Affairs Manager with Nestle Health Science. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Wendy Wismer about taste changes in cancer. Wendy Wismer, PhD, is an associate professor in the Department of Agricultural, Food, and Nutritional Science at the University of Alberta. She's a food scientist with experience and expertise in sensory and consumer science. Wendy's research program characterizes taste and smell alterations among people with cancer and their impact on food choice, nutritional status, quality of life, and clinical outcomes. Dr. Wismer is passionate about improving the food-related quality of life of patients with cancer through pragmatic interventions and support tailored to their unique taste and smell preferences. Thank you for joining us today, Wendy, to talk about this important sensory phenomena and the implications clinicians may consider when working with people who have cancer.
Thank you, Bethany. It's a pleasure to join you.
So, Wendy, to begin, can you briefly describe what taste alterations are experienced by people with cancer and what is known about why these taste changes happen?
Sure. I think most people are quite surprised to learn that the changes in taste experienced by people with cancer are really unique to the individual. I think we often have an idea that it would be like the age-related reduction in taste and smell perception that we find among seniors, you know, where if you're thinking about music as an analogy, it's like turning the volume right down. But in actual fact, for people with cancer, you know, some of the basic tastes might be reduced in that way, but they might also be absent, or they might be even stronger, or they could be completely altered. So a different taste or smell could be perceived. And that combination is really different for each individual. So you had asked about why they happen. You know, there are a variety of hypotheses. There's nothing that is conclusively linked as the cause to these taste alterations, but it's essentially any of the treatments that are designed to destroy rapidly dividing cells, which are cancer cells, but also taste bud cells and olfactory neurons. So our taste buds and all our olfactory neurons do rejuvenate every 10 to 14 days. So they are also destroyed with the therapy. And some of the chemotherapies, particularly the taxane-based therapies, are notorious for causing taste alterations. And then, of course, radiation therapy that's designed to destroy those cancer cells can impact the salivary glands and destroy taste buds. And then additionally, surgeries for head and neck cancer can actually just simply physically remove taste buds and may alter the nasal passages and the olfactory pathways. So there are a variety of sort of ramifications, I guess, of the cancer treatment. And then additionally, it suggested that inflammation is probably a cause of taste alterations. And in fact, that might be something that occurs very early on for the patient, because we do find that there are some patients who come to treatment with taste alterations, and they'll tell you that that's one of the reasons they knew that that something was not right in their body, or these taste alterations.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was, as you were talking through that, I was thinking for people with head and neck cancer, it sort of makes intuitive sense that they would experience taste and smell changes, you know, related to treatment and so on, and the area that's affected by their tumor. And although you did say other systemic treatments, you know, can cause taste and smell changes as well, Wendy. So this is a phenomena that's not unique to only head and neck cancer patients, is it? It's for people with a wide variety of malignancies may experience changes. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. So no matter what the tumor type, really any treatment is going to generate taste and smell alterations.
And you mentioned that for some people, you know, when they're diagnosed and before treatment begins, they may have these changes related to, you know, inflammation and other things that are happening. And how long do these changes normally persist when we think about courses of treatment and what happens along people's cancer journey?
You know, that's something else that is really unique to the individual. So we have people entering treatment with taste alterations, and sometimes people will say that's how they knew that something wasn't quite right with their body, and that eventually led to the cancer diagnosis. But I think most frequently we see the taste alterations develop around the midpoint of therapy, when we've had a couple of cycles of chemotherapy or, you know, a few rounds of radiation, and then they seem to be quite intense until the end of therapy, after which for some people there's a fairly rapid recovery, while for others they never feel that they gained their sort of normal sense of taste and smell back. So again, it's a real individual journey.
Mm-hmm. So much variability.
Mm-hmm.
Wendy, thinking about these taste and smell changes that are happening, what are some of the implications they have then for people with cancer?
You know, the impacts can be quite intense, in part because when taste and smell alterations occur, they're part of a whole suite of symptoms, such as, let's say, nausea, early satiety, diarrhea, fatigue, and altogether they really impact food intake and the enjoyment of food. So you have these alterations going on that are changing the taste of food and generally making it fairly unpleasant. And you have a whole lot of symptoms and the treatment. So it's more difficult to think about food choice and taking in food. So you have those two things that really are working against food intake. And so as a result, clinically, we see lower energy intake and lower protein intake to the point really where it's inadequate, decreased variety in foods. And so that reduces the diversity of micronutrients that an individual is taking in. So from the nutrition perspective, it's really negative. And there often is inadequate intake of calories to really tolerate treatment. And then that results in poor progress or prognosis overall. So really not positive, you know, just from that sort of clinical nutrition standpoint. But then there's also food enjoyment and quality of life, you know, the social benefits of food. And that also really declines. You know, family and caregivers want to provide the patient with their favorite food, you know, and keep them strong and keep them healthy. But for the patient, because of these taste alterations, they often don't enjoy their old favorite food because it doesn't taste like it should. And so sharing a meal and going to a buffet or a birthday party or something is not something that's enjoyable at all. So it's really overall a very negative experience.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting, isn't it, Wendy, when we think about the role that food plays in our lives, it's so much more than just sustenance, isn't it? I mean, that's obviously a very important, particularly for somebody that's going through cancer treatment, but then the whole, you know, the pleasure of eating, the social aspects of eating can have a profound effect on people. And as you mentioned, their families and those that are close to them.
Yes, exactly.
So thinking about some of these impacts that you discussed, what kinds of interventions or management strategies have been suggested that might help manage taste alterations?
You know, there are some sort of traditional ones I can tell you about, and then a couple of sort of advances that I've noted. So I think typically we see things like tip sheets that are available from almost any clinic. And there's a lot of really good sort of tip sheet advice that's available online. And there's some really great tried and true ideas, but it is maybe a bit of a challenge for the patient to work through them and find those that fit best. I think we increasingly see support groups associated with different clinics, and that can be really helpful to have that firsthand experience and share ideas and insights among individuals who maybe share the same tumor experience or maybe the geographic area and the support that's available. And another one that I think is really key is letting people know ahead of time what the taste change experience might be like, or to be prepared for them and just know that a lot of the foods that you find comfort in right now may be a lot less desirable over time. And one of the recent advances I see in that area really takes off from that idea. There have been a few studies where taste alterations have been assessed either with, you know, tasting solutions and or questionnaires, and then giving feedback to the patient so that they know in what way their taste and smell has changed. So the patient experience to start out with is, oh, you know, this is not good. I don't like it. Things don't taste great. You know, I can't rely on my favorite food anymore. And then when you go through the tip sheets and things like that, they're very specific. You know, if you perceive a metallic taste, if things are too salty, if they're too sweet. And for the patient, they may not be there yet. You know, they just don't know what it is that's changed, but they do experience the change. So if we can do this basic sensory assessment, either through those solutions or questionnaires, and provide that feedback to the patient, then they may be able to take better action and use those tip sheets type of thing, or just know the way that things have changed and modify foods accordingly. So by analogy, the example I was thinking of would be someone that normally consumes, let's say, a regular coffee as a double-double, you know, two cream and two sugar. And if it turns out that they have reduced bitter perception and heightened sweet perception, that coffee is not going to taste great. So when you put those together, it would probably taste quite weak and it would be too sweet. So if the patient knew that their bitter perception was reduced and their sweetness perception was enhanced, and maybe with a little support, they would then choose a coffee that had a stronger flavor, like a dark roast or something like that, and not go for the double-double. Maybe they would just have the cream and cut out the sugar. So I think there are things that we can do to modify the taste of food for patients that are going to better align with those taste alterations. So I think that's a real avenue for support there.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as with so many things in, cancer treatment, I guess life in general, if we have an idea of what to expect, you know, and it can make a difference for people. And so they understand that, okay, this is normal what I'm going through, and then help them, like you say, be able to differentiate and understand exactly what all the are those alterations they're experiencing, so then they know what corrective action they may be able to take. Are we seeing, Wendy, from some of this newer research that this is, you know, having an impact on patient outcomes? Is it, you know, moving people in a slightly different direction in terms of what they're able to eat and drink and achieve from a nutritional or quality of life perspective?
You know, the few studies I've seen this in this area have been very positive in that regard. So we mentioned previously that it's, you know, sort of there's the food intake with the nutrients, and then you can layer on to that the social enjoyment of the food. And providing that specific information about the way tastes have changed for a patient does seem to really be a very positive thing. You know, it does seem to allow more control, greater food intake, you know, greater support from family and caregivers, and more enjoyment of food. So it's a real sort of spiral up kind of phenomenon. And it certainly is something that I think would be valuable to explore, you know, more widely. Mm-hmm. I think one of the challenges is too, is that as an individual, you know, we don't really know much about our sense of smell and the taste. So we've probably heard of sweet, sour, and bitter, but if you were to evaluate some solutions and I asked you which one was which, that could be a little bit more challenging. So with a little bit of education about taste and smell in general, I think we can really empower patients to manage their taste and smell alterations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an exciting possibility and something that is, you know, could be quite practical for people and make a difference. Mm-hmm. So thinking about that, Wendy, you know, how this is evolving, what else do you see in terms of, you know, what's happening in this field of taste and smell alterations, how our understanding is changing, and then, you know, what might be on the horizon for this field?
You know, I see a couple of things. So one would be that there's greater examination of sort of the genetics of taste and smell alterations. And it's possible that individuals who have certain genes switched on for taste, so maybe a super taster, which is someone with a generally heightened sense of taste, you know, maybe those are the individuals who experience taste alterations as most bothersome and most troublesome. Mm-hmm. So people who are super tasters often with this heightened sense of taste are more likely to be foodies, you know, and so they would be more negatively impacted by not being able to enjoy their favorite foods or by having the flavor of foods, you know, sort of off. So that would be another thing that would be quite important to know is if you could have some idea ahead of time, you know, who might be most negatively impacted, you know, can we start supporting you right away? And then the other area I see where there are some really great advances are in developing food products for patients. So providing the nutrients that are needed in the cancer settings, so more protein, omega-3s, things like that. And also choosing flavors that maybe are novel and different and are going to be more accepted. So we've traditionally stuck with, you know, chocolate, strawberry, and vanilla, which gets a bit tiresome, but I noticed that there are a lot more sort of peach, mango, maybe, I don't know if you want to call them softer fruit flavors or something like that. And then I think the other thing with those flavors is that they're not so common. And so we don't have so many expectations about them. So chocolate for us is ubiquitous, and we have in our mind a real expectation of what chocolate should taste like. So when you have your liquid oral supplement and it's chocolate, it, you know, it might not be the chocolate that you want. But if I gave you raspberry vanilla or something like that, you might not have any expectations about that, or peach mango. And so you are a lot more likely to be satisfied because you didn't have this rigid standard of what you were expecting. So there's that. And I also see more sort of snacks and beverages that are more traditional, but with those added nutrients, portable, convenience, et cetera, for patients with cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an area that certainly has been evolving. I can certainly speak from a food production perspective, we're seeing that. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, Wendy, when I used to work as a clinician in oncology, I would often try to get a sense of what people's relationship with food was like. And, you know, at that time, I didn't necessarily think of people as foodies, but I definitely saw what you're talking about, that, you know, people that had this, you know, real, you know, interested in food and the pleasure of eating and all sort of the tactile, you know, different aspects of eating, they did have a harder time, generally speaking, when that changed. And I really like and appreciate that idea of expectations, because it's so true. We've all grown up eating and drinking, and we have certain ideas of what things taste like or should taste like. So introducing a different flavor or combination of flavors, you know, that's an approach that for some people, like you said, they may not have the expectation of what that tastes like. And so it becomes more acceptable. That's, I hadn't really thought of it quite that way before. So that's really interesting.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you, Wendy, for taking your time today to provide us with a better understanding of taste alterations and the implications that they can have in cancer care. And as you've talked about, you know, these sensory changes are common among cancer patients, and they really can interfere with not only appropriate and adequate delivery of nutrition, but also that aspect that's really important in terms of quality of life and the social aspects of eating. And it's nice to hear that, you know, some simple strategies, and even just starting with discussing, you know, what to expect with people can have a positive impact on outcomes. And I think is something that, you know, can be doable in a clinical environment. So before we sign off, I do want to take a minute to ask you one last question so our listeners can get to know you a little bit better. Can you tell us how you first became interested in the field of nutrition?
Sure. So I have always been interested in food all my life. And I think sort of healthy living, and I didn't pay a lot of attention to nutrition until I studied taste and smell, particularly as a motivation for food choice. So when I was growing up, we had always been told, you know, sort of eat to Canada's food guide and things like that. And I always tended to think of that as a huge factor of food choice. You know, you should choose what's healthy. And then of course there's what's available, maybe what's appropriate for the situation, that kind of thing. But I didn't really think about the impact of taste as a driver of food. And now that that area is growing, this nutrition sensation area, I've become a lot more interested in nutrition.
And I mean, there's so much to be said for if things are enjoyable. And I think one of the things that we sometimes hear is that, well, if something's healthy, it doesn't taste good. Or, you know, there's all these different sort of ideas or perceptions, in some case, maybe misperceptions around food and nutrition and taste. But they are so intimately connected that, and ultimately most people do want food to be, and eating and drinking to be a pleasurable experience.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So on that note, we'll conclude this podcast. I want to thank you again, Wendy, for joining us, and thank all of our listeners. This concludes our episode of the Clinical Nutrition Notes podcast. For more podcast episodes, visit Clinical Nutrition Notes on nestlehealthscience.ca.